You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a winter day. Don, it feels like winter.
It's technically fall, but we have suddenly gotten close to maybe some freezing weather coming up, at least frosty weather. Looking at this coming week, we've got some rain. We've got a possibility of frost. We've got sunshine. We've got a little bit of everything. And we are dropping down our daytime temperatures. Normal for this time of year, we're going to be in the upper 50s. Let's go through the week. Oh, was that you being cold?
I don't like it when it's cold and wet and rainy. I know.
All right. So the day of the broadcast, which is going to be November 14th, 2024. I think I have that correct. Right. Is going to be showers likely that day. Now, we just had a little bit of rain and there were some thunder showers and a little bit of snow up in the Sierra. And then we're going to, you know, have some nice, sunny, clear, pretty days. And then these showers are going to push back in. There's a couple of storms sort of pushing through. The highest likelihood of rainfall is further north in the valley and up in the mountains and the coast range. But it looks like we could get a quarter inch one day and a quarter inch the next day, just sort of a passing series of showers. What's interesting is the temperature between those passing series of showers. So let's go through this. Thursday night will be 40 degrees with showers likely. Friday, 57 degrees will be the high with a 40% chance of showers. Friday night, mostly clear, 36 degrees. Saturday, 58 degrees and sunny, so brisk but sunny. Saturday night, 34 degrees and mostly clear. So what that tells me is a pretty good chance of some visible frost on Sunday morning, depending on how quickly the next little group of showers comes in, little storm, because Sunday there's actually a slight chance of showers after 10 a.m., but it'll be mostly sunny during the daytime with a high near 56. Sunday night, chance of showers, mostly cloudy with a low around 38. Monday, slight chance of showers, mostly sunny, high near 58. And Monday night, mostly clear with a low around 35. So there's also a possibility of frost that night. I want to mention it, but this is not any kind of frost that you need to be worried about unless, as we mentioned a week or so ago, if you still got some of your houseplants outside, they probably should come in. You should probably check them for aphids and certainly for ants in the soil before they come in. Do that on one of these nice sunny afternoons that's coming up because you don't want to bring those things inside with your plant. But any of your tropical houseplants should probably be indoors. What we're doing right now at our nursery is walking around, going through the succulents and the other plants where there are some individual species that are a little more cold tender, and we're pulling them out, putting them in a flat, and moving them closer to the building. That's all we're doing. So jade plant, some of the aloes that we happen to know are a little more tender, some of the haworthias that have more translucent leaves, we're just moving them up closer to the building under an overhang where there'll be a 3 or 4 degree temperature difference just in case it gets cold enough either of those nights that I mentioned to do any injury to those plants. The building will give them the protection that they're after. This is not a cover your young citrus kind of frost, or do we need to go out and harvest this, that, or the other kind of frost? No, this is just our first, probably, night cold enough to get down to see some visible frost and possibly do some injury to tropical plants. I'm not really concerned about subtropical plants, and that would include the citrus and the other ones that people are always concerned about. But we do have A little bit of rain, a little bit of sun, some cloudy weather, and a chance of frost. A little bit of everything coming up in a fairly typical November pattern. The temperatures are, of course, dropping pretty rapidly. We're getting down into the upper 50s for our high. So obviously the most common question we're getting at our nursery is it still okay to plant this, that, or the other? Meaning vegetables, flowers, can I put in those shrubs? I went to the Arboretum sale and I bought these. Is it too cold to plant them in the ground? And so on. We can go through those all very quickly. There's still plenty of vegetables you can plant. We just get away from the things that need a long lead time. So you can plant spinach, lettuce, kale, broccolini, broccoli raw, mustard greens, collards. All of those things are just fine. Some of the broccolis are fine. Mostly the smaller headed types will give you good results right now. It is not time to plant Brussels sprouts or the old fashioned broccoli or the cabbages that need 90 days. No, those need more lead time, so it's too late for those. But it is plenty of time to plant lots and lots of other things. You can still direct seed radishes. It's okay to plant things like beets from seed, or you can buy little starts of them if you prefer to do that. You can plant Swiss chard, and you can plant onions right now. I want to tell you, though, we got in 32,000 onions about a week ago, and we have less than 10,000 left. So onions go very quickly when they come into garden centers. You better move fast if you're going to get some onions. Garlic can still go in, but it's in very, very short supply. So that was just a quick run through. Yes, there's still plenty of vegetables you can plant. Anything that's a cool season, winter flowering annual, which we'll talk a bit more about later in the program, those can certainly go in now with no problem. Yes, those plants you bought at that native plant sale or the Arboretum, all those hardy plants, they're woody plants that you know are hardy in this climate zone. It's a great time to plant them because the soil moisture is something that's easier for you to manage, and they're not going to be stressed by the transplanting process. Really, the only things I don't like to plant, let's say December 1 through early to mid-February, are the subtropical things. I don't really like putting citrus in when the soil is cold. I don't really think it's a great time to plant. Well, I just had this conversation with a guy, mandevillas. This is not a time of year to put in something that's really between a subtropical and a tropical. You should come back and get that in, let's say, April or May. True tropical hibiscus. Nope, not a good time for those. But for the most part, anything that is considered hardy in this zone, it's a great time to plant it. And especially native and low water plants and things like that, it's an excellent time to get those in the ground. So the fact that it's getting colder, and it's come on rather suddenly, I think is part of it. It was, you know, 102 degrees in the first week of October. And here we are barely breaking 50 during the daytime in the second week of November. That's a pretty typical pattern here. If you happen to be new to this area, just so you know, that's not an uncommon drop in temperature for the time of year. But most things go in just fine right now. Also, still a great time to throw seed on your lawn. Still a great time to throw out some wildflower seeds, especially with three or four light storms coming through, because then you wouldn't even really have to worry about watering them.
Before you get off on that watering, so we've had a little bit of rain. Mm-hmm. We're planning to have a little bit more rain.
Yep.
Is this a time to turn off my sprinklers?
Or not? I've answered that question several times this week, and the answer is it depends. That's a good answer for the most part. You know,
the way I figure it is, it's time to turn it off, but then keep track of when it's raining. So if it doesn't rain for a couple of weeks, turn it back on.
You might need to turn it back on. That's the thing. For example, if you seeded your lawn or you put in some wildflower seeds, and these are young seedlings that are just getting going, I wouldn't count on the rainfall. You should probably continue to run your sprinklers at least a few minutes a day for those, because those are seedlings that are coming up. For things that you've put in the ground recently, you should check daily, water as needed. But I can tell you, both from experience and just from all the data, you won't need to water daily. You just need to check daily, because within the last 10 days, we've had a 3-day north wind that dried things out considerably. And we've had some rain that's got some moisture there. Plant water use has dropped considerably. The ET rate is about half of what it was before, but a dry wind can do a lot of damage to a young seedling that you just put in. Having said that, I planted peas out. I'm so proud of myself. They've gotten past the white-crowned sparrows. They're established. They're growing. Yeah, I put them in 2 weeks ago, I think it was. And I've only had to water them 3 times since I planted them. And one of those was in the middle of that north wind. I had to go out and, you know, water them very thoroughly. Other than that, though, the soil is staying moist enough that it depends on your soil. It depends on the plant and how big it is. And when I say it depends on your soil, there's one case where you definitely do need to keep an eye on the watering, and that's things that are in containers or in things that are like containers, like that raised vegetable garden that you have where you filled it with a nice fast draining soil. It's retaining moisture pretty well, but it is going to be drying out faster than, say, your native garden soil. So I hope that answers your question. Check daily. Water is needed. It depends. How's that? That's our corollary to our usual. Yeah. Add that to our usual aphorism. So, all right, we've got a couple of those announcement kind of things that we do. Let's see. The UC Davis Arboretum and Public Garden is having their clearance plant sale. It's a little tight with this show, but it'll be on Saturday, November 16 for the final plant sale of the season until spring, as they mentioned. Members receive 30% off. Non-members receive 20% off, and their clearance inventory is now posted. So you can go see on this massive spreadsheet how many things they still have, and you can find that out by going arboretum.ucdavis.edu. That's Saturday, November 16th, and I think they all start at 9 in the morning. That's not right in front of me. Let me double check.
Yeah, it's 9. Yeah.
9. Okay. And that's everybody's welcome, but you got a better discount if you're a member. 30% off.
You can join at the door.
I believe so. Yeah. So that's the final sale for this season. There is some great programming here at KDRT, and we always talk about the public affairs shows and such here on the Davis Garden Show. But you know, there is really an amazing amount of music programming, and one of my favorites is Crossing Continents, which is a world music show. Gil Bedavoy, who's lived in Davis since the early 1990s, has been involved with radio almost since then with KDVS and is now here at KDRT. Gil covers the Middle East, the Mediterranean region, North Africa, Central Asia, and the Indian subcontinent.
Wow, he travels a lot, doesn't he?
Or at least he gathers music from a lot of places, including traditional and contemporary music styles. As he says, this is not a pop music show. That's World Music Show, Crossing Continents with Gil Medavoy. That is live Mondays from 10 a.m. to noon. It does rebroadcast, I believe, during the week. So if you want to see the rebroadcast time, just click on the schedule guide. And if you like the programming, including Davis Garden Show, including Crossing Continents, including That's Life and all the other great programming here, just click on the schedule guide first and then go over to the support button and send us some money. And we love it when you folks do that. You know something else we enjoy? When you come say hi. And the other day I had a very amusing experience at my nursery where I heard myself walking into my nursery.
You heard yourself?
I heard myself walking into my nursery. I thought, that's a familiar voice. And one of our listeners was playing the Davis Garden Show on his phone as he walked into the Redwood Barn Nursery. So there I was talking as I walked into the nursery. It's great to meet you guys.
He must have had a real big grin on his face.
Yes, he enjoys it. He's a regular listener of the Davis Garden Show, and it's always fun to meet you folks. I do want to mention, back in the summer, a really nice couple came in, same thing, came in and said hi to us. We love to meet you when you could stop by Davis. That's a Redwood Barn right there on Fifth Street. I wish I'd had a chance to talk more to those folks. Apparently, my staff says they said some really nice things about the Davis Garden Show. So great to meet you. Great to hear from you. Always fun to hear my own voice on the radio.
And you should tell your staff, if anybody mentions the show, to hey, hang on, here's another one.
It's another listener coming in.
Yeah, come over here and introduce yourself.
Yeah, he had a couple questions that we'll get to a little bit later in the program as well. All right, what have we got, Lois? Okay,
so I have so many questions today. One is from me, Lois, in Davis, who has a situation where I have a landscape fabric, and then a couple inches of the stuff that has fallen on it in the past 15 years or so, and then quite a few inches of arborist wood chips. Mm-hmm. Yep. So my question is, I know things can grow in it because the weeds did just fine before I put the arborist wood chips down. What about if I took some of those onion starts and just tucked them into the wood chips so that the bottom of it was down where the little detritus soil is? They're not long lived. They aren't, they're very shallow footed, aren't they?
So you want to grow onions in a mix of arborist wood chips, leaf debris, and maybe some
on top of the landscape fabric.
Yeah, I don't know how successful that'll be, but I strongly urge you to give it a try and give us a report in May or June. People do grow, some plants are very well adapted to growing in what I call duff. That interesting mix of soil and leaves and sometimes needles, you know, under your redwood trees, things like that. I've had ferns, I've had cyclamen, I've had certain plants that can adapt very well, apparently, to living almost entirely on decomposing organic material, some soil. The thing you're missing in that mix would be any actual soil in there. So that might be helpful if you really want to try this. And onions wouldn't be my first choice, but something.
Keep it straight up. It will be supported.
Yeah. First of all, your yard's too shaded for onions anyway, is my impression. But I think what you would run into is a great deal of difficulty as we get into the warmer, drier part of the season, keeping them properly watered. Onions are really easy to grow, but they need even moisture as they're growing all the way through to March or April or even May, as they then go into the process of forming up onion bulbs. And I'm guessing you would have trouble giving them what they need at that point, because the duff will start to dry out too quickly. Again,
I was thinking that they were just a winter only thing, and then by when the plum tree above them started leafing out, that they would be done and I would harvest them.
Yeah, that's the thing. It wouldn't be done by then. In fact, that's a good point. People are buying onions right now. This is when you buy them in this area, Sacramento Valley, Northern California, interior Southern California, pretty much all of lowland California. This is when you plant onions with best results. They're buying young seedling starts, transplants. They're basically, they're bare root onions. They look like when you go to the grocery store and buy green onions. That's what you're planting. They look like scallions. And they grow through the winter. Some nitrogen is helpful to get them growing early. Some source of nitrogen, doesn't really matter that much what it is. Even moisture, but of course in the wintertime, that's almost always provided by nature. There have been drought years where people have had to irrigate them January, February, but that's really unusual. We start to get to March or April, the days are getting longer and it's warming up. They still need good moisture, March, April, about into May. And somewhere in there, they start to trigger the process of forming up bulbs. It varies a little bit by variety. That's what they do here. Those of you listening in colder climates, you plant in late winter, early spring, and you're harvesting mid to late summer, and you do particular types of onions good for your region. Here, they all do well. We're in an area where you can grow almost any kind of onion that you choose. November planting, they start to form up in about April to May. By the end of May to June, they're ready essentially to harvest. You go through a process of drying them off. The one that I sell that takes a bit longer is Walla Walla, which actually is that big one from Walla Walla region of Washington. That does very well here in the Sacramento Valley. People are often surprised to learn that. That you don't harvest typically until mid to late June or even July. And you can also plant that one, by the way, in February. My kid did that. Got a couple hundred of them from a coworker who didn't know what to do with them, planted them out, harvested them in late July. And that did very well for us. So we have a lot of flexibility here, but you have to be able to dry them off, but not abruptly. And so you need to be able to taper off on the irrigation. In rainy climates, they manage that by elevating them, planting them up on furrows so that water always drains away when there's an excess of it, so that if they get rainfall in April, May, June, which I'm told happens in other parts of the country, then the water at least will percolate away from the bulbs and they won't be subject to rot. But it's real important that you manage the irrigation correctly and taper off. So that's the part that you would have trouble with, growing them in your unique blend of harvest wood chips, leaf debris, and whatever else is in there.
So it sounds like, obviously I'm giving up on that whole thing.
Yeah, no onions.
But from what you said, it sounded like I could probably grow them in a pot, because I have one sunny area. I mean, I have one sunny area, room enough for two pots. Yeah. And so I could put them in a pot and grow them and control the water and things like that. Yes. I've done carrots that way.
Yeah, you can. You can do onions the same way. And they would they benefit from some nitrogen. But other than that, yes, containers would be.
The question is, how tall a pot do I need to? Because I have to accommodate not only the roots, but the bulb, because they grow underground.
Yeah.
How tall a pot it is, and how deep do you plant these little onion sprouts? Because an onion, a big onion, is going to take a bunch of room under there. And don't you have to have the roots below the onion?
Yeah, they go down about 3 to 4 inches. 2 inches is fine, depends on the variety. But people often mulch in order to make sure that the onion itself is protected. Three inch depth is typical. Although, by the way, you don't have to be that careful. Most people, that's one of the things that's so cool about onions. Almost anybody can grow onions if you have enough sunlight. You take the right kind of a hoe, which is an angled hoe. You drop it on your nice, loose, friable soil. That's important that it has to be loose. And you pull a trench, little narrow, shallow trench that's maybe 4 inches deep. And you just drop the onions down into it. And they're mostly going to be down 4 inches, but some will be 2 inches. Some will be 3 inches. Pull the soil back over it, water them in. That's it. You're done. It's that simple. It really is. You don't have to do anything more. Now, some nitrogen is important. I think I've said that a couple of times. So either turning something in that's got nitrogen in it, like manure, or feeding them early on, only early in the growth cycle. You're not trying to get tons of top growth. You just want to get these little guys off to a good start. They'll grow a bit. They'll kind of stop as we get into our colder, gloomier mid-December to mid-January period. As soon as the days start getting longer and the sun comes out in late January, they start to push a fair bit of top growth. And at that point, it's just a matter of watering them. As for your container, though, I have grown many vegetables in pots to try and see how well that works. And I would say that if I were growing onions, I would put 6 plants in a 15-gallon container.
15-gallon container?
Yeah, that's my absolute minimum size for growing most vegetables because it has a 1.5 cubic feet of soil, and that's enough that you won't get to March or April and be having to water literally constantly. I have grown onions in smaller pots, and it works. It works. They just dry off faster, so they bulb up faster, so they're smaller, but it still works. So don't give up on it. You'll get, you know, half size onions, but they're perfectly good flavor. You can do that in a smaller container. But just bear in mind that if you put them in something small, as soon as we start warming up in March, remember how quickly things dry out at that end of the season. So your season might be truncated a bit. Anyway, I strongly suggest you plant some onions and give it a try. It's lots of fun. The thing is, you can use them green. So, you know, even if it, you know, even if you don't actually get a proper onion out of it, that's fine. Also, for those of you that don't have enough sun for onions, think about leeks or shallots. Because there you're using the stem, or in the case of shallots, you're not counting on a giant bulb forming. And those are actually pretty easy to grow. And you can use the green part. It's, you know, it's traditional to use the green part of both of those. So those are things that you could try in a smaller container, and you'd probably get more satisfactory results. Leeks are great. They're lots of fun to grow. And you know, they have a great flavor. They're, people don't think of them because they think there's some sort of a gourmet French thing you only use for certain types of recipes. They're just another onion. It's just another onion. You know, if you like elephant garlic, it's more closely related to leeks than it is to onions or garlic. It's a very similar kind of thing. So they're all pretty easy to grow. And the cool thing about onions is you can pretty much use any part of the plant. So give it a try, but bear in mind that you probably don't have enough sun to get what you're after. However, that duff zone does grow certain really cool plants. There are bulbs that thrive on that. Cyclamen would be great in that situation where you're getting a steady supply of leaves coming down each year. It'll just go dormant when it runs out of moisture. Some of the other bulbs, some of the grape hyacinths, some of the other fall planted spring blooming bulbs would probably work fine. As I mentioned, I've used under my 2 redwood trees, you deal with redwood needle debris and all that stuff. I use ostrich fern. And at one point I put in maidenhair fern, and they just got this constant pile of needles coming in that enriches them and gives them something to grow on. In fact, I looked at that. I collect ferns. I keep them in pots and I bring them out when it starts to rain. Based on what's happening under the redwood tree, I've started taking a nice fancy potting soil and burying my ferns in 2 or 3 inches of soil once a year. I mean, just literally cut them back and bury them, and they push right through it and they flourish on it. So I basically adopted the deciduous forest strategy of fern management using an enriched potting soil that was actually originally designed for cannabis. So they're getting pretty high grade stuff there.
Okay, let's go to the mailbag. We have Catherine from Davis who writes, "Hi, Don and Lois. I so appreciate being able to ask you questions." Yes. The photo attached is in the southeast corner of my back garden. A cherry tree was there for years until the fruits started rotting. Blech. Now what I really want to plant there is a desert willow, but I wonder if it would get enough light. You can see the large bay tree on the other side of the fence. It blocks the morning sun. I think it would get about 5 hours a day at this time of year. Is that enough for it to thrive? If not, could you suggest other trees? I love conifers, but don't want dense shade because just north of this corner, I have raspberries and strawberries planted. Thanks for your help.
Yeah, conifers would be more challenging. No, desert willow would do great from what I see there. So this does raise a question that we get very commonly. When you see the phrase full sun, you know, something needs full sun, what does that really mean? Here in the Sacramento Valley, 4 to 6 hours of sun is plenty for most plants. Desert willow is Chilopsis linearis. If you travel on Route 66, US 40, down through Arizona, New Mexico, you see it everywhere, which, by the way, is where it's from. It's you'll see it playing around gas stations, you know, RV parks. In fact, I had to walk over and look at these horribly mutilated trees at an RV park thinking, why did they do that to crepe myrtles? And why are they growing crepe myrtles here? Oh my God, it's desert willow, and they've done the same thing to them. they had headed them back as if they were pollarding them, which, let me just tell you, that's not a good thing to do to, well, anything, but definitely not a desert willow. They seem to be okay with it, but I do not recommend it. Heat tolerant, drought tolerant, reasonably fast growing. Only drawback to them that I have found, and I've had a couple customers who've had this experience, as with many Southwestern plants and many California natives, when we grow them here in our rich soils that hold nutrients and hold water, they grow very fast. 5 to 6 feet a year is what the first one I planted 25 or 30 years ago did. And I thought, wow, this is great. Look how fast it's growing. Look how big it's getting. It's
going to fall apart too.
Look how tall it's getting. Look how narrow those branch angles are. And about 15 years in, the thing split in two. And that is what can happen if you aren't careful about how you train the branches and how you, you know, how you water them. Certainly don't fertilize them. You don't want enriched soil for something like this. It's a plant that comes from the dry parts of fairly poor soil areas, but gets subject to torrential rains every now and then, basically the American Southwest. The washes fill with water intermittently. They're not constantly irrigated. These are plants that can take considerable drought. Tree Davis and the city of Davis were planting a lot of desert willows in dry areas and parks and places like that, because they can actually go completely without irrigation once they're established, even here in the Sacramento Valley. And they have these beautiful blooms. It's not a willow at all. It's only called a willow, as with so many things, because it has these narrow leaves that look kind of willow-like. It's actually in the trumpet vine family, Bignoniaceae. And when you look at the flowers, they're the same kind of tubular trumpet flowers. The original species is light pink. There are now stronger pink, purple, bigger flowered ones, bicolored ones. There's a bunch of them. And they attract hummingbirds and they attract bumblebees, carpenter bees like crazy. They're very, very popular with pollinators and they bloom all summer. So they're kind of a good alternative to the crepe myrtle in some ways. But I am concerned when I see it go into a garden, and this does look like a garden, that it will grow too fast and not be properly trained. So you need to make sure to get the good placement on the branches and watch for narrow branch angles. But it will be replacing, here's a good point, a cherry tree. Cherries are something you can water deeply and infrequently, and the Chilopsis or desert willow would be just fine with that as well. So if you put it in and watered it like a fruit tree, deep watering once a week, maybe every 10 to 14 days once established, rather than light, shallow watering like your flower border might get or a lawn might get, you'll probably get a bit slower growth and better branch structure, but you still need to monitor for that branch structure. I will say they do set pods, and those pods for some reason bother some people. So there are podless forms out there that you can look for. I don't really think that's necessary. I don't personally think the pods are particularly unsightly, but as you do explore this topic on, you know, the internet and the Western Garden Book and such, you will find that there are seedless or pod-free forms. The pods aren't glaringly ugly. In fact, they're kind of interesting, but if that really bothers you, you can look around for those. I think that Bubba, it's literally the name of a pink bicolored one, or Burgundy, which is a strong burgundy pink one, are two of the best, but there are some others out there as well. So Chilopsis linearis, it's a high open light shade. You're not going to get a lot of heat reduction with this, but it's a very beautiful tree and it's easy to garden under it. You can have very low water plants compatible with it, lavender, rosemary, native plants, and you have a number of different things that are quite compatible with Chilopsis. They'll be great as well. So just make sure that they're compatible on the watering so you don't plant something that's going to need a lot of water near your desert willow. But it looks like you have plenty of sunlight for it there. By the way, with respect to the fruit rotting on the cherry, that was more likely spotted winged Drosophila.
It's
black, yes. It's just not a rot. It's actually an insect infestation. And just for those of you who keep asking me every year when we get to the fruit tree season, hey, they got a cure for that spotted wing Drosophila on cherries yet? The answer is nope. It is still a problem. And if you want fruit that doesn't have worms in it, you're going to have to spray. And I mean spray several times as the fruit is ripening. So sweet cherries, pie cherries still have that problem. So buy for the cherry tree. Go ahead and put in a desert willow. And I think that would be a lovely addition to the yard. It'd be a nice, you know, what your neighbor has in that picture is a great big bay tree in the background, dark green, you know, that great big solid mass of foliage, which hopefully they won't ever take out. It would be great for the desert willow as a backdrop, because that would be a wonderful complement in terms of the foliage, the flowers of the desert willow against that dark, dark green of the laurel. That'd be great.
All right. Our next question comes from the mail. Oh, by the way, Don, if someone wants to write to us, what do they do?
Oh, they go to davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
All right. Ilya from Tiburon writes, you mentioned your mentioning of mandarins in your recent show made me take a closer look at two trees I planted a year ago in my front yard. One is looking good and has one large green fruit hanging on one of the branches. The other tree has suspect light yellow color throughout its leaves. See the photo attached. Please let me know if, in your opinion, it needs fertilizer or what is causing this discoloration. Anything for your weekly listener?
Okay, we have a couple questions back at you, which would be, how are you watering it? And have you fertilized with anything? What I see here, I won't post this with you, but
variety. I mean, she has two trees. Are they different?
Yeah, be curious what the variety is, if and if, how you're watering it, and whether you fertilized it with anything in particular. This appears to be a pretty serious micronutrient deficiency, but I'm always cautious about diagnosing those on citrus because they can be caused by other things like watering too often or, regrettably, fertilizing with high phosphate fertilizers. I managed to do that to some of my trees at one point. I always love to tell you guys about the mistakes I make. I went out and took a big old bag of fertilizer from the garage to go out and feed my young citrus in about their third or fourth year. And I was about three trees in when I realized I was using triple 16 instead of citrus food. And triple 16 is indeed 16% phosphorus. That's what the name refers to. Well, phosphate fertilizer can, when overdosed, or even applied at the label recommendation, suppress the ability of the tree to take up certain micronutrients. I am increasingly of the opinion that many of the trace element deficiencies that I see on plants are actually from excess phosphate, excess phosphorus. A soil test, of course, would be the answer to that part of the question, but that's a fairly expensive thing to get done. Not a bad idea if you're having this kind of thing, but you might want to get a soil test done by a lab, send it out to them. But the first question is, have you used any fertilizer on this? And was it high in phosphorus? Because when I did my pumelo with this triple 16, it showed micronutrient deficiencies for 3 years after I did that. The plant, by the way, is fine. As I've said before, at some point, we're going to do a whole show on the weird things and problems that I have seen on my own citrus trees, but they're growing fine and yielding anyway. And one of them is this apparent micronutrient deficiency that I inadvertently induced by using triple 16 fertilizer. Most citrus foods nowadays are lower phosphate. They're usually something like a 3-1-2 ratio, 14-6-3, that kind of thing. Triple 16 is more phosphorus, and it was a faster acting source of phosphorus. Why does that affect the micronutrients? Because we know that phosphates suppress the growth of mycorrhiza. If there's an excess of phosphorus around the roots, it's hard to get it around the roots because it's usually adsorbed pretty quickly by soil colloids. It's a little technical stuff there, but hard to get it there. But if you did, if you used a fast-acting source and you did more than was called for on the label, you can actually suppress the growth of the important soil mycorrhiza that take up micronutrients and make them available for the plant. So while my plants were growing fine, they would show this kind of sort of mottled yellowing. And it wasn't, you know, specifically manganese or magnesium or zinc or any. I mean, I could probably figure out one of those trace elements. But what we encounter at our nursery, and this is true at hardware stores as well, people coming in with a leaf symptom of deficiency, wanting something to correct the deficiency when they've probably caused it some other way. They probably caused it by watering too often or applying a high phosphate fertilizer. So that may be what you're dealing with, in which case, when you fertilize in the future, just nitrogen, not a balanced so-called fertilizer, not something that's high phosphorus, not a high bloom fertilizer. But I do want to ask about how you have been fertilizing, how you have been watering, and what the variety it is, because it may be a simple matter of just giving nitrogen, watering deeply rather than shallowly, and letting it grow out of that particular deficiency. There are ways you can correct deficiencies if it's an actual deficiency, but it's usually an induced deficiency. And also, I note you're in Tiburon, which is a lot cooler than here. So it may well be there's just a variety of mandarin that doesn't do as well there as the ones that we do here in the valley. So that's why I'd be interested to know which variety is doing well and which one is showing these deficiencies.
So I'm looking at this picture and I'm not a citrus grower. I live in a shady place and I'd never be able to grow a citrus of any kind. But it looks a lot like some of the ornamental plants that are green and yellow in color. Are all citrus that dark green, or are some citrus actually this color?
I think the color of citrus is more related to temperature, soil nutrition, and other factors. They're generally dark green. So when a citrus is not dark green, that tells me that something is amiss. However, I'm glad this picture came right now, even though this is only slightly relevant. As we get colder, citrus trees get yellower. These are truly subtropical plants, and so they don't really like to go below 50. They'll do it. They'll tolerate all the way down to freezing and even below freezing in many cases, especially mandarins. But as we get colder and we get into the 30s at night, it's already happening on my mandarins, the young ones on my farm, they'll start to yellow more. And I guarantee the most common question we'll have about citrus now for the next 3 months will be, why is my citrus yellow? And we'll explain that it's temperature related. It also is a sign that the plant will want some nitrogen. You know, we do go through that process every February, March, where the new growth is beginning and the plant mobilizes nitrogen to the new growth, so older leaves yellow. But in general, as we get into November, December, January, yellowing is very commonly just temperature related. So it cures itself. By April, nobody's coming in asking us why their citrus trees are yellow because the night temperatures have gotten warm enough. So that may be a factor here, that the overall yellowing could be related to that. But I was able to zoom in closer, and this has pretty classic, you know, manganese deficiency appearance. But again, I don't think it's something where you're going to go out and buy a trace element and correct it. I suspect it's environmental or something to do with some inadvertent aspect of soil nutrition. So we'll wait for some answers on that. But yes, the overall yellowing is in general is related to temperature as we get into this time of year.
All right, here we have a new listener, Sharon in Tracy. And Tracy is down south in the Central Valley. So it's
near Stockton.
Similar climate to ours. Yep. So hi, Don and Lois. I recently found your podcast and have been steadily working my way through your back catalog. Okay. Oh, such a treasure trove of information. Question for you. 8 years ago, we had our west-facing front yard professionally landscaped. The company put thick landscape fabric over the heavy clay soil and covered it with 2-inch layer of decomposed granite. Oh, what a mistake that was. The yard is blazing hot in the summer and covered in weeds in spring. I think it's bull thistle, purslane, hawkweed, I'm not sure. Weeding is a pain. If I weed when they're little, the little roots pull up the decomposed granite like a carpet. If I weed later, the roots have grown through the landscape fabric. The only area that is easy to weed is a patch of miner's lettuce. It pulls easily out of the ground. I thought about planting miner's lettuce seed all over the yard. Okay. I'll eat the other weeds, but... Yeah. Lettuce seed is expensive. I heard Don talk about planting oats and other grasses in winter to outcompete weed roots. What I'm looking for is a shorter, more inconspicuous cover crop that I can pull out when needed. Any suggestions? Thanks. Right. We love your show. That is one of the strangest questions I think we've ever had.
Well, it's a common one. I recently saw something on a Facebook group where someone had gotten a bid from a landscaper, and the first thing they were going to do was put down landscape fabric and then gravel or decomposed granite. And literally every answer they got was, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. Now, there are places, I need to say this, there are places where geotextiles, woven landscape fabric, can be appropriate. I use it for paths on my property all the time. For very intractable weeds that you just can't deal with any other way, it can be effective for Bermuda grass and things like that. It can be nutsedge, you know, as you still have to monitor it because they're capable of pushing through it. But in a what you might call a fairly desperate situation, it could be appropriate. But it does, just like a question we got a week or so ago about putting down, you know, cardboard and sheets and things, water puddles when it gets to landscape fabric and it backs up before it soaks in. So when you do put down any kind of thing that isn't soil or soil-like, you increase runoff. You increase runoff from your landscape into the gutter, into the storm drain system of your community. And that is not desired. That's something that cities, municipalities would really prefer you not be doing. So it would be better in most cases to not use any kind of fabric unless you need it for a path or a particular situation, but leave it open. However, that's not an option here. Going in and taking out that landscape fabric, especially with agaves as the central plant in the landscape. I have lots of experience with agaves in the landscape. As we used to joke in my mother's succulent and cactus garden in San Diego, don't turn your back on them because if you back up, you'll back into them. And we all did that at one time or another. So we don't have a real easy answer on that since it's already in and done. It's a done deed. Not much you can do about that. Miner's lettuce is a cool plant. It's a native annual that comes up in the fall, grows through the winter. It's eaten. It's where the name comes from. And it does seed itself. So I wouldn't hesitate to, you know, find the little seed things on there as it gets towards the end of the season and spread them about. When I'm talking about using cover crops, which is what I'm referring to with oats and other grasses to outcompete weeds, I am talking about vegetable garden or orchard settings where the easiest thing to do will be to just go in and mow them. You're not going to be able to pull them out very readily. In a shorter plant for this situation, if you were trying to go that option, would be annual ryegrass. But I just feel like you're going to make work for yourself. It's just going to be hard to pull out because it will try to root through the landscape fabric and you'll have a lot of trouble pulling that out. The weeds you're describing, and this is a key thing about weeds, anytime someone walks in and says, I need to know how to get rid of the weeds in my yard, I look at them and I try to say as nicely as I can, what are they? And they say, what do you mean, what are they? They're weeds. And I say, well, we need to know what kind they are because we need to know what is the adaptive strategy that is making this weed such a problem for you. In other words, how is it outwitting us? Because every weed that is a weed has some such strategy. Is it coming up from bulbs down there like oxalis does or like nutsedge does? Or is it coming up from little pieces of stem like Bermuda grass? Or does it reseed prolifically like spurge? Or does it shoot its seeds like oxalis? Those are the things you need to know so you can get ahead of it by figuring out where is its weak point in the strategy. Well, you mentioned bull thistle. Well, that blows in. That's how that came in, hawkweed probably as well. So the problem people have when they do landscape fabric and mulch is there's always the weed that arrives by air. Dandelions, thistles, things like that. Milkweed will spread the same way. Anything that can fly on the breeze can land on your decomposed granite when it's raining, root right into the decomposed granite. And now, well, you've smothered all the things that were down below, you now have the weeds that are coming in from above. We do repeat our dictum, our aphorism about weeds. All weeds are easiest to control in the 2 to 6 leaf stage. And a hoe is probably your friend in that particular situation. The hoe that I would use is a hula hoe or action hoe. You can find those at most hardware stores. They're not a conventional hoe. They're a round flattened thing and you drop it on the ground, you pull it towards you and it breaks the weed off right at ground level. And then you just leave it there to wither away and then pick it up later after it's dried up. So you will find that that particular tool will help you because it doesn't leave a bunch of divots behind like a conventional hoe would. You're just basically taking advantage of the shallow roots of the seedlings in the 2 to 6 leaf stage, dropping the hoe down and pulling towards yourself and basically decapitating them there. Works for annual weeds, doesn't do much for anything that's coming out from a bulb or a stem.
Okay, so I have a lot of questions about this one.
You have a very similar situation, don't you?
No, I put arborist wood chips down. I don't plan to have any weeds next year. We'll see how that.
I'll tell you, some things will blow into your arborist wood chips, but they've got a harder job there because they've got to land on, what do you have, 12 inches of wood chips? They've got a root, and they've got a sprout on top of big chunky stuff. Get their roots down. I guarantee some will. Get their roots down rapidly before they dry out. So a big chunky geometric mulch, I love that term. Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott used that term, geometric mulch, is actually really more effective than something that's more dirt-like, like decomposed granite. A seed lands on decomposed granite, it's basically a seed bed for it. So that's part of the problem here. You'll have less of an issue, but not zero issue.
Okay, so a bunch of questions. As you said, that decomposed granite is basically a soil structure for it.
Yep.
So if you were to take some herbicide and just individually squirt just a little tiny bit on each one of these things as they come up, would that work? I know lots of people don't like using it at all.
Well, yes, there are. Yes, you can spray with a systemic herbicide and kill the root system, and a very small amount will do it. This also would be a very likely case where some of the organic or low toxicity herbicides that are derived from fatty acids of salts of soap, for example, those would burn it. And as I say, 2 to 4, 6 inch, 6 leaf stage, it would kill it. It would probably kill kill most of the things we've talked about. You get them when they're young, it'll work. And so if it's something that's taprooted or difficult, then you'd probably want to look for one of the old-fashioned ones. But this is a case where those ready-to-use products that you're seeing more and more in hardware stores, read the label. Read the label and then do some homework. Here's a little thing we tell people all the time. You're looking at this product, you're standing there, you're looking at a whole big display of them, and you're confused. It's a lot of technical information. Well, you know what? Take a picture of it, go home, type the exact product label into Google, and up will come the PDF of the label that you can't read because the type is too small on the bottle. Now you can read it at any size. You can make it bigger and read all about it, how to use it, when to use it, what to be careful about, how dangerous it is, environmental impact, and so forth. And you should read that carefully. And I really hate the fact that most people are making under-informed decisions standing in the hardware store looking at the thing on the shelf when they really need to read the label before they buy it. Almost all these things that are on the market now, these new weed killers that you're seeing, are very low impact, but they're not zero impact. And you do need to read about how they work and where you need to be careful and all that kind of thing. But this would be a case where some of those, I'm not going to say acetic acid, but the other ones that are derived either from plant materials or from plant alcohols or from, as I say, fatty acids of soap are going to work pretty well. They'll just burn the plant down, but it's very similar to just chopping it off with a hoe. But again, I urge you to learn how to use a hula hoe or action hoe. I think you'd probably find that very effective.
Don, I'm thinking blowtorch.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Well, and you don't have to call it a blowtorch.
Those you can get ones that you have for your creme brulee.
Yes, they make them for weeds. Actually, they make those exact things for weeds. So you can buy a propane torch to go out and kill weeds. And obviously, they're really bad for drip systems and for other nearby plants. So use them very carefully. This is something where you should be.
But this is on rocks.
Yeah, so we don't decomposed granite. And of course, you're typically doing this when it's kind of wet all around them. They do work very, very well. You just have to obviously be very careful with them and only use them at the right time of year. But they make them specifically for weeds, weed flamers. And they often come with a covering that directs the flame in a particular way. Even very difficult to kill weeds, if they have a big like crown like a dandelion, you hold a flame on that for 5 to 10 seconds, you will kill it. I guarantee it. So the only issue I have with those is you got to be careful with them. But that might be something you'll find very useful in this situation. Because it's from the picture, it's an open landscape area. It'd be pretty easy to do with a flamer and a fun thing to do, too. I highly recommend you buy your spouse a propane weed killer for Christmas.
And then take with you a nice piece of wood to hold up against the agave so that it's protected from any backsplash that in case you're not really, really good.
Yeah. No, that's true. Flame weeders work. Flame weeders work. They've been using organic farming for years. You just have to be, you know, careful, obviously. And we don't recommend them anytime outside of the rainy season. So be cautious with them. So that's another possibility. But I don't think there's going to be a grass that's going to work in this situation. What I've been talking about, and I do think this works very well, and more of you could consider adopting this for your vegetable gardens, your open areas, seeding in something that's vigorous that outcompetes the typical weeds. And a smaller garden, I always used annual ryegrass. That worked very, very well. It would come up in a matter of 5 to 7 days, even in surprisingly cold weather. It makes a very pretty, it's a shiny leaf blade and it's a bright green. So it makes a very pretty meadow-like effect. And then you just make sure to mow it off before it, you know, when it flowers, you just mow it before it goes to seed so you don't have it seeding all over the place. You can just mow it, let it lie there, maybe mow one more time. You don't even have to rake it up. Just let it go on into the soil, particularly when you're using it as a cover crop in a vegetable garden or a setting like that. Now that I'm on a bigger place, I like oats because they get taller and they really shade out weeds, but I still use annual ryegrass at times. And one of my favorite combinations in recent years has been oats with peas. And you take regular oats, which you can buy online, some nurseries sell them, and you mix them with either the Magnus pea or something like that. These are field peas. They're starchy. They're okay. You can eat them. They're great in soup and stuff, but these aren't sweet, lovely peas like your grandmother made. These are a little starchier and less interesting, but they're vigorous. And my neighbor planted his whole property in them a couple of years ago. He used oats and the Magnus looked like the Magnus pea. The whole thing turned into this mass, this biomass of vegetation, about 4 feet tall. He had to go over it a couple times. He waited till I think about May to finally mow it. And it was very wet and just, you know, nothing in that field except oats, peas, and a whole lot of red-winged blackbirds because they absolutely love that cover. So it's a great cover crop for wildlife as well. But that's for bigger areas for those of you with more of perhaps a rural property.
So we were talking a few shows ago about low water plants, low water landscapes, and shade plants. And one of our listeners, Andrew, wrote in and said, here are a few photos of that, quote, low water shade plant, unquote, that I mentioned to you last Friday. I assume he came in and talked to Don. I've learned that the term, quote, shade plant, unquote, means considerably different things to different horticultural organizations, depending upon their perspective. This plant, and it's called Pseudopanax crassifolius.
Very good.
This plant is endemic to New Zealand, where it apparently seeks more shade than it does in Great Britain, where the Royal Horticultural Society says it can take full sun, that is, full British sun, right, which is not the same as full California sun. I provided two links below to discuss this plant. The Wikipedia article is extensive.
It is, yes, indeed.
I read these articles. It's lovely articles. The plant is the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. It's like a stick with downward pointing needle-like leaves. And I mean, it's seriously, it's, you know, 12 inches across. It's huge, but it's tiny circumference. And then after 15 to 20 years, the top of it suddenly becomes tree-like. The leaves change, it branches out, it's way up there. It's just bizarre.
Well, it's fun. This was kind of a little bit of a trip down memory lane for me to see a plant whose name I've seen in books and in references, but literally never actually seen in person. Is that the term we use? Haven't actually seen the plant. It's Pseudopanax crassifolius. Lancewood is the common name, but that's also a common name for another plant. I gather the New Zealand name is Horowica. There are plants that spend the early part of their life in the shade, growing up then into the sun. In fact, rather famously, trees like oaks will do that. They'll come up in the thicket and they'll grow straight up through the thicket, being protected by the spiny, thorny plants from marauding animals. They poke out the top, woof, up into the sunlight, and then they take over. And this appears to be something that grows up in from the shade into the sun. And a good example of something that does that here locally is bay laurel, Laurus nobilis, will grow in the shade and then eventually get up and will also take full sun. So what intrigued me about this was that I immediately saw the family that it's in, which is Araliaceae, the Aralia family. And there are a couple other members of that family that are famously tolerant of the shade, such as Fatsia japonica, the Japanese Aralia, which is an Araliaceae, such as English ivy, which I don't really recommend, but it's in that family and is definitely shade tolerant. And in some situations, in a container confined area, English ivy or any of the ivies can be perfectly suitable. Minor digression here. One time when I was over at the Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens in Fort Bragg, if you've ever been there, they have a big laugh house where they allow garden clubs to come in on a sort of a rotating basis and bring in examples of all the things they grow. And I was there once when the Ivy Society.
There's an Ivy Society?
Indeed. Had been given the whole run of the place. And it was full of all these fascinating cultivars of Hedera helix, regular old English ivy. I bet you didn't know there were 50 to 100 varieties of English ivy. Well, if you're looking for an interesting plant for the shade and you promise to keep it in a container and not let it get away from you, Hedera helix is certainly a possibility. And I mentioned that one because in this digression into Araliaceae, somewhere back in the 1940s or 50s, I think it was, they crossed Fatsia japonica, the Japanese Aralia, with Hedera helix, the English ivy, both shade-tolerant members of Araliaceae, and came up with Fats Hedera lizzii. And I was working at a nursery in the 1970s, and it came into the trade kind of a big way because it was novel, and it was called the botanical wonder because it was a cross between two unrelated genera. How could this possibly be? It's not supposed to be possible to cross two different genera. Well, they did. One, that tells me that maybe the taxonomists are wrong. Maybe they should be in the same genus, but it created this fascinating plant for deep shade. It's even grown as a house plant. Fats Hedera has the leaves of Fatsia, star-like leaves, smaller but dramatic tropical-looking leaves, on a plant that grows like a vine, like Hedera helix, but doesn't climb on its own and doesn't root into things and doesn't go crazy. So you have this plant that you can train. The first one I planted, I trained up on a wall, sort of just stapling it to the wall in this fascinating pattern. It was just fine with that. It was very malleable in that regard. It's never going to go crazy and run all over your yard and root into the wood and run into the neighbor's yard like hetero would do. It's not this great big bold shrub like Fatsia japonica is. It's just an interesting plant for considerable shade. So members of Araliaceae are a good place to start. And there's others. There's some house plants that are in Araliaceae that you could consider in a sheltered location. But Fatsia japonica, Heterohelix, if you promise me you're not going to put it in the ground, or Fats heterolizii. Thank you for the link to something in Araliaceae that I've never actually seen in person, but we did at least give you some possibilities for considerable shade. Fats heterolizii is one to look for. And of course, after this thing had been on the market for 30, 40, 50 years, and they're propagating it by cuttings, variegated forms occur. It's very common in horticulture for striped or mottled or whatever leaves to occur on something that you're propagating by cloning. And so that's happened. And now there's two or three varieties of Fats heterolizii that have brightly mottled leaves. So you get a little spot of color in dark shade. These are for challenging spots, the kind of place where Aspidistra, which is the cast iron plant, or Sarcococca, or Ruscus. You know, I think those are the three we mentioned last time. You've got that difficult, dark environment, in many cases with an overhang, so it's not even getting winter rainfall. That's fine with Fats hetero. That would actually work very well.
Another listener asked, how close a cherry tree should be planted to an existing cherry tree in order to provide cross-pollination? It's a Bing cherry.
They can be very close together, but they don't have to be close together because bees do the work for you. So it can be across the yard. It can be in your neighbor's yard. I guarantee cherries are very attractive to bees. They will fly from the one to the other with no problem. It doesn't have to be that close. Across the yard is fine. His question, he then turned it around. How close can it be? Oh, how close together can he plant cherry trees? Depends on how much you're willing to prune. I have seen cherry trees planted as close as 6 to 8 feet apart. But if you don't make sure that one of them doesn't outgrow the other, that's what's likely to happen. You'll have to prune to accommodate them to each other's canopy. But anywhere in the same yard is fine. And you can put them just a few feet apart as long as you're willing to prune so that one doesn't overgrow the other one.
And these are cherries. Are these Bing cherries also going to get the fruit fly problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's you need to know if you're planning on growing sweet cherries, pie cherries, spotted wing Drosophila is going to be a problem actually anywhere cherries are grown now. And so you can read about what people do about it, but it is a lot of spraying. It's really sad because it used to be that I would talk about fruit trees and I would say, who here doesn't want to do anything to their fruit trees at all? And then people would raise their hand. I'd say, all right, plant a fig, pomegranate, persimmon, or cherry. Now I say fig, pomegranate, persimmon. Cherry's not on that list anymore. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
Hello, it's Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.